Third case set for argument this morning is Michael Arneson versus GR Management and Risk Administration Services. It's appeal number 30494. Brad Lee appears for appellant. Michael Arneson will be arguing, and Charles Larson appears and will be arguing on behalf of the appellees. So with that, Mr. Lee, you may proceed with your initial argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, Mr. Larson, may it please the court. My name is Brad Lee. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Michael Arneson. The issues before this court here today deal with whether this court should reverse the circuit court's reversal of the Department of Labor's decision, finding that claimant Michael Arneson proved his work injury was a major contributing cause of his development of atrial fibrillation, and that he was permanently and totally disabled under the odd lot doctrine. Today, we'll ask this court to reverse the circuit court's determination because it failed to apply the appropriate standards of review in its decision. There were multiple areas where the department failed to, where the circuit court failed to follow the appropriate standard. It ignored and omitted multiple factual determinations that the department found significant in ruling for the claimant. It also failed to explain why the department's factual and credibility determinations were clearly erroneous, or how it had a definite and firm conviction that a mistake had been made. Instead, the only thing the circuit court did in this case was substitute its judgment for that of the department, which is contrary to South Dakota law.
So this is...
Go ahead.
As you lay out the facts going forward, please, that you refer to, know which are by deposition and which were presented by live testimony and what deference they should be given.
Would you like to know that now, Judge?
Well, no, but as you go along.
Absolutely.
There are a number of questions here, but and that will be helpful because there's a different standard in our review.
So. Absolutely, and I think that's something that the circuit court failed to appreciate when it performed its decision and reversed the district court. In performing these reviews of agency...
So let me jump in with a question before you get going here. On the question of causation and the court's determination, reversing the department's determination on... causation on the fibrillation issue. If we reverse on that, then we pretty much reverse on the odd lot as well. Doesn't that kind of go with it? I mean,
I would agree with that, Chief Justice Jensen, based on the record that you have before you, because the circuit court failed to articulate and follow the appropriate standards of review when it addressed the perm total issue as well. There's two steps to the perm total issue. In this case, the circuit court merely found that because he left his work, he's not employable or not entitled to benefits. It neglected to address the first step, where claimant has the burden, where the department found that he proved he was permanently totally disabled, made a prima facie case. At that point, the burden then shifts to the employer. The circuit court did not address that in any fashion whatsoever. So the only issue the circuit court developed with regard to the permanent total disability claim was the fact that he left his work at the Mineral Palace. So yes, I agree that if you do find that his atrial fibrillation was caused by his work injury, then I do think also on the second issue as well, you'd rule in favor of the claimant.
It is a unique scenario we have here, though, where we have, you know, and I think he characterized it as he decided to retire. Does that have any impact then on the prima facie showing? And couple that with the testimony from the employer that was admitted at hearing that they didn't intend to fire him and that they would have made accommodations. So how does that affect his prima facie showing?
Again, I think, Justice Devaney, this goes back to the importance of the standards of review that we follow when we're conducting these appeals and the deference we give to the trier of fact. Appellate courts, as you well know, are looking to find whether there is substantial evidence, not contrary to the findings, but to support the findings. And in this situation, Judge Faw made a credibility determination regarding Mr. Arneson. There were numerous underlying factual issues that were contended at hearing. Okay, this is not one of those cases where we have a stipulated factual record and it's two medical doctors fighting based on deposition testimony. It's much different than this. The employer and insurer attacked Mr. Arneson's credibility from the beginning of this. They alleged he didn't have palpitations after the injury. They alleged the amount of problems he had from his atrial fibrillation were not accurate.
But is there, I'm sorry, forgive me, and I want to let you get back to your causation too, but as long as we're on this topic, I had a question on it. It almost seems like there's a logical component to this idea that someone can't be obviously unemployable if their employer says, we'd employ them. So regardless of the formula for burden shifting and prima facie case, at some point, the way I read it was just, hey, this just fails logically. You cannot be obviously unemployable if we'll employ you, if the employer will employ you. Is that, and if you accept that, that would really kind of neutralize credibility out of it. It's just more a function of logic. Maybe that's too simple.
I don't think so, Justice Salter, and here's why. I liken this case to what we have when we have pain complaints, all right? We have situations where administrative law judges are required to listen to the testimony of witnesses, claimants, doctors, and determine, is the level of pain that this person is suffering from so high that this person cannot be required to work? I've had claimants, you've probably seen litigants, where they may be able to do their job, and at the end of the day, they lay down, they take ice, they take medications, just so they can have the energy to get up to work again. And then on the weekend, when Friday's off, they lay there. I think Mr. Arneson's case is the same thing. He tried to work for 10 months, and the testimony is undisputed. He could not do his regular duties. He tried, but he couldn't. The unrefuted testimony is, even if he walked across the casino, he would become short of breath to the point where he would have to sit down for 5 to 30 minutes. And it's not just, geez, I'm tired. He would have an atrial fibrillation episode where his heart would start beating rapidly. He'd have chest pain. He'd be dizzy. I don't know if you've ever had a situation when your heart started beating uncontrollably and you didn't know why, but it's scary. And I think what Mr. Arneson decided based on the record is he couldn't get better. He wasn't going to better. He could not keep doing his job again.
So I think it follows from that that your argument is also that it's a bit of a misnomer to say that he retired. He stopped working because he was incapable of continuing to work. He didn't retire in the traditional sense that, hey, I'm 65, it's time to hang it up. I mean, that seems to be what you're arguing is.
That's absolutely right, Justin Myron. And this is a classic situation that we face where insurance companies are heads we win, tails you lose. Mr. Arneson tried as hard as he could to work and keep his job and get better. He didn't get better medically. So finally, he didn't think it was fair to his employer. He didn't think it was fair to himself, so he quit. Turn it the other way. If Mr. Arneson had tried to go back for one day of work and couldn't do it and said, I quit, the response would be, you didn't even try. We don't even know if you can do this. So I think this is, again, consistent with what the testimony has been about this gentleman. He was a hard worker. They liked him. He wanted to be there. And Judge Fobb determined that and made a credibility determination saying, based on what I've heard about this gentleman and the live testimony I've heard, this is a person that wants to work. And if he could work, he would. The other fact that we talked about, and Justice Kern, you talked a little bit about this, is we have different avenues of testimony that are very important to consider here. We have a treating doctor in Holloway. As you guys know, as you justices know, an examining physician is entitled substantial weight over a records review doctor, which is Dr. Brody. Then we have the live testimony of Dr. Elkins. Elkins came live to testify. Judge Fah had the opportunity to listen to Dr. Elkins testify. And all of you justices, whether as litigants, prosecutors, or trial judges, have known there's a difference between deposition testimony and live testimony. In deposition testimony, we just see the words. But in live testimony, even when you're listening to oral argument, you can hear the words coming out of somebody's mouth, but you look at their body, their tone, their tenor, and you say, I don't believe a word this person is saying. And that's the example that happened with Dr. Elkins. And in fact, Dr. Elkins, who admitted he's not an expert in any of these categories, and we'll get to that, he was testifying, and I would never expect my good friend Mr. Larson to remember this, but on redirect examination, after I crossed him very well, I thought, he was so desperate to try and convince the judge that he was believable and that he knew what he was talking about, that he was rambling on and on to the point where Mr. Larson couldn't get a question in. At one point, Judge Fah and I looked at each other and started laughing. Now, is that in the record? No. But that's a perfect example of why we give so much deference to the trial court when making these factual determinations and these credibility determinations. And the important thing to understand when you look back at Judge Klinger's opinion, she says the appropriate standard, but then never applies it. Not one of the finding of fact did she address and say, this is clearly erroneous. At not one point in her opinion did she say, I'm firmly and thoroughly convinced that a mistake has been made. All she did was state, I'm persuaded that the employer insurer's doctors are better than the treating doctor. Unfortunately, that's not the standard. And if that is the standard that this Supreme Court adopts, it's completely contrary to law, and it's a very slippery slope going forward for trial courts across the state.
So talk about the medical evidence in that regard. Go ahead and tell us about the medical evidence and why you should prevail.
So Judge Fah agreed with Dr. Holloway's testimony in preference of the testimony of Drs. Brody and Dr. Elkins. I think significantly, and maybe this is why the circuit court left this out of her opinion, Drs. Elkins and Dr. Brody agreed that this was a case that involved the interplay of multiple medical conditions, Graves' disease, thyroid problems, cardiac issues, and electricity. With regard to the cardiac issues, Dr. Brody said, yeah, he's an expert in that, but he's not an expert in Graves' disease, never treated somebody with hyperthyroidism, and never treated anybody that's involved with this type of situation. Same goes with Dr. Elkins. He admitted, and I put it in my brief, he's not an expert on any of these topics, yet those are the opinions he's giving. And so then again, we go back to the medical evidence, Justice Salter, and here we have the judge having to take the live testimony of Elkins, who's an occupational medicine doctor. Then you have a cardiologist who admits he's also not an expert in thyroid problems. And then you have a treating doctor, which is Dr. Holloway, who's an internal medicine doctor that does handle all of these issues, did treat them in this case, reviewed all of the medical records, conducted research on his own, and came to this conclusion. And an important part, I think, to keep in mind is Judge Fah made a credibility determination that Mr. Arneson was having heart palpitations in the days after the electrocution event. That's significant because in forming their opinions, Drs. Brody and Drs. Elkins were under the assumption he did not have any heart palpitations until 12 days later. Now, I address that impeachment, but that's important because the basis of their opinions in their reports was that he didn't have complaints. The judge determined that he did have these complaints. And what this court has held is that when there are two permissible views of the evidence, a choice between them cannot be clearly erroneous.
Other than Holloway, had either Elkins or Brody treated individuals who had suffered electrical injuries?
I think Brody had treated people that had electrical injuries that may have affected their heart. I do not believe Dr. Elkins treated really anybody because of his practice. He's an occupational medicine doctor. Neither one of them had what I would say a lot of experience in this. That's why Dr. Elkins took it upon himself to have to do research to try and figure out what these conditions were and how they interplayed. So the basis of Dr. Elkins' opinions are just based on the articles that he reviewed. It really is no personal medical documentation or experience that he has. Going back to, I'll touch on one argument, a very significant piece of evidence that the circuit court relied on was this 1 in 1,000 statistic. All right, Mr. Elkins came out and testified that it was a 1 in 1,000 chance that an electrical shock like Mr. Arneson had would cause these heart arrhythmias. If you'll look back, though, this fact is not based on Elkins' personal knowledge because he's never treated these conditions, so he had to find this from articles. However, if this statistic was so important, why wasn't it set forth in either of the doctor's reports? It wasn't set forth in the reports. When you look at the articles that the doctor relied on that I pulled and marked as exhibits, this statistic is not stated in there. And then if you look at his testimony, which changed over the course of his testimony, first he said there was 5,000 patients, so it was a 1 in 5,000% chance, or 1 in 5,000 chance that you'd get atrial fibrillation. Later on he said, well, I just used 1 in 1,000 because it was higher, even though I think he meant lower. However, later on, In his redirect examination with Mr. Larson, and I think this is when he was going on and on and on, he said, there's not you have a 1 in 10,000 risk, you have a 1 in 1,000 risk of developing atrial fibrillation. There just aren't even enough cases to generate that estimate. The reason this is significant is because Judge Faw disregarded this opinion about this statistic so much, she didn't even put it in her report. It wasn't even a finding in fact. It wasn't even something she accepted. Yet the circuit court had pulled this out of the record and accepted this as though it was an absolute true fact. And she said, because it's 1 in 10 on one side and 1 in 1,000 on the other, then it must be the 1 in 10 that caused this injury. I see my time's about up. I'll reserve the rest of it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Larson, you can proceed with your argument.
Chief Justice, Honorable Court, Mr. Lee, this case deals with a couple of issues. The first is whether possibilities are sufficient to prove causation. The second is whether someone can retire from a job that they're able to do and then claim disability benefits for the remainder of their life. I'm going to start with the permanent total disability standard. The standard review was whether the department's decision was clearly erroneous. We concede that. The applicable statute is SDCL 62-4-53. It states that the employee has the burden of proof to make a prima facie showing of permanent total disability benefits. If they do that, the burden then shifts to the employer to show the availability of work that is continuously and regularly available in the community. The Department of Labor's finding or conclusion of law 213 was that since they found the prima facie case of obvious unemployability, there was no need to go to the next step. Well, that's an error under the law. That statute continues that if the employer has the ability to show work that's open and continuously available, the effort to seek the employment from the employee is not reasonable if they place undue limitations on the kind of work they're willing to do, or if they purposely leave the market. Now, the circuit court found that the Department of Labor was clearly erroneous on the obvious unemployability. And I think one of the questions was, well, how can you be obviously unemployable if you're working a job? Not only was Mr. Arneson working that job for 10 months, he never had restrictions during that time. He never asked for accommodations. He was never written up. In fact, the only critique was that he wasn't delegating enough. He supervised 30 employees. The point was they wanted him to continue to work. He had intimate knowledge of the inner workings of the employer. The undisputed testimony was that had he not retired, he would continue to work there. That was the testimony of the general manager, the owner, and the gaming manager.
So who gets to say that? And, you know, as a reviewing court, is it too late for us to really credit one over the other? Does a fact finder have to consider it again? In other words, who gets to say, I can't do it? Does the employee have the ability to say dispositively, yeah, I can't do it? Or does the employer say, oh, yes, you can, and we'll even make sure that you understand you can continue, and we'll accommodate you, and thereby neutralize this claim, which may be viewed as the employee's subjective perception that he or she just can't do it.
Yeah, so that's where you look at the totality of the evidence. So not only did he work for 10 months, he wasn't under restrictions, never asked for accommodations. When he retired, the testimony from Deanna Prado, the general manager, was that when she asked why he was retiring, he said, it's time. And then he asked if he could continue to work there part-time. So if you look at that testimony, there was some argument about chronic pain. Well, that's not this case. It's not in this case.
So, counsel, you know, it seems that the law requires that employability be analyzed by considering all the factors in the aggregate. And there are a number of factors in here, and I'd like to hear your view on those. He's 69, I mean, at this point, approximately. He's got an impairment in his hand. There's testimony that He can't walk. He has age. He has walking restrictions, sitting restrictions. He can't operate machinery. And you know, Audette testified in person to this, and the and FAW found his testimony to be credible. What view should this court give that evidence that's in this record in light of the fact that we have to consider employability in the aggregate?
So I think that's where the public policy argument comes in. So you have an employee who, at the time, I think he was 64, 65 years old. He's older now, obviously. He had a job that they were willing to accommodate. They were willing to keep him on full time. That was undisputed testimony. If he was having heart issues, they didn't care if he sat down for 5 to 30 minutes and took a break. During that time, he was able to do his administrative work. And so what claimant wants to do is retire, and he did say he retired. He didn't say he was quitting because he wasn't able to do the job. He said he retired because it was time. And so the public policy argument is this employer, now are other employers going to hire a 69-year-old individual with disabilities? I don't know. During COVID, maybe. And that was a testimony even from Audette, which was claimant's expert, was that employers were desperate for work. And while he may be slower at doing the work, Mr. Audette agreed that an employer would rather have someone slow at the work than not have someone in that job at all. So you do have to look at someone in the aggregate, their age, training, experience, and the type of work in their community. Even with that, Jim Carroll, who has over 40 years of experience, was able to identify 8 jobs that were open and available, and he said that was just a sampling. And Mr. Carroll spoke with my client, Mineral Palace, about whether they would accommodate the restrictions long term. They said they would. That testimony came in, not only that Mr. Carroll spoke with them, but then each of the individuals testified that they would have accommodated him long term. And so we have a situation where an individual wants to retire and then ask their employer to pay their work comp benefit for the rest of their life. We don't know if another employer would have accommodated those restrictions, but we do know that this employer would have accommodated those restrictions.
Does the retirement matter? So let's say we had a scenario where, I get your argument about his current situation, but where he was still employable at the time he retired, but 2 years later, or however long later it is when he's requesting his permanent total disabilities, now he's at a stage where he's not unemployable. Does the earlier, does that matter then? Does the fact that he earlier retired when he could have stayed employed?
No, I believe there's case law from South Dakota which states that even if you retire, if the reason you retired was because of your disability or your restrictions, that the court would find that you can still be permanently totally disabled. So the fact he retired isn't the end of the conversation. The fact he retired, coupled with the employer's willingness and ability to accommodate him long term, is really what we're looking at. I initially was wondering if remand was necessary in this case. So the Department of Labor did not address the burden shifting in SDCL 62-4-53. I believe that all of the evidence and information is there for the court to determine that Mr. Arneson purposely left the labor market, and under SDCL 62-4-53, that precludes a finding of permanent total disability benefits.
Does that mean we could make the opposite conclusion on this record too?
I'm sorry.
Does that mean we could make the opposite conclusion on this record? You're suggesting that we wouldn't need to remand it. We could find that this record establishes that he was not obviously unemployable, and so he's not entitled to permanent total disability. Could we make the opposite conclusion if we thought the record supported it?
I think you can. Yep. I think the information is necessary. Now, the vocational experts testified live. There was other testimony. If you feel that that's a determination that the Department of Labor needs to make, I get that. So I'll leave that to you.
So we could only, is it your view, we could only decide it ourselves that there weren't things we determined were disputed facts from live witnesses, or still trying to figure that out in my head.
Yeah, no, I think the information's there. The findings of fact are there. The only thing we're missing is that burden shifting. So the department found that Mr. Arneson was obviously unemployable, which Circuit Court felt was clearly erroneous given the fact that he was still working and there were jobs available. The burden shifting would then go to the employer. I believe that this court has everything that it needs to address that and make a decision. My fear is that if it gets remanded, we're going to be up here in another 2 years speaking with you, which is fine.
But then we become the finders of fact on the live witness testimony in looking at the employability or whether there were jobs available dispute.
Yeah. But because the administrative law judge is the one who observed the live witnesses, were we to take that path, probably the best approach would be to remand and have the administrative law judge who saw the live witnesses make that additional assessment that you are indicating the judge failed to make.
That is one avenue, and I would have no issue with that. My point is there's no dispute that Mr. Arneson left the labor market. That's in one of the conclusions that he retired. So I believe that the record settled on that. But I grant all deference to you if you feel that that's necessary to remand. On causation, we had one live witness, Dr. Elkins, and then deposition testimonies from Dr. Brody and Dr. Holloway. Claimant would have this court apply the clearly erroneous standard across the board, and including Dr. Holloway's testimony. I don't believe that's accurate. Dr. Holloway testified via deposition. That would be de novo review. And critically, the Department of Labor did not reject Dr. Elkins' opinions, did not say that they were unfounded, that they were unsubstantiated or against the evidence. It simply found that, in the department's opinion, Dr. Holloway's opinion was more persuasive. So let's look at that. There's no dispute that claimant Mr. Arneson had pre-existing hyperthyroidism. Dr. Holloway, again the treating doctor, testified that between 10 and 15% of the general public would get atrial fibrillation, or AFib, through hyperthyroidism. His opinion on causation was based on two facts. One, that it was so rare, the 10 to 15%, that an individual would get atrial fibrillation from hyperthyroidism. And two, that the AFib started soon after the electrical injury. Well, the second one is the temporal sequence, and that's been rejected by this court on many occasions. On the 10 to 15%, Dr. Elkins agreed with that's the general public. Mr. Arneson was a smoker, a white male. Given his age and his Graves' disease, that increases that likelihood. Now, claimant has argued that the 1 in 1,000 figure was simply made up. Well, Dr. Elkins is the one who researched publications, articles, did his own research. He did say in testimony that the 1 in 5,000, he said, if we give claimant the benefit of the doubt, let's go with 1 in 1,000.
Can you refresh my memory? Claimant took a 440 volt shock that went through his body. We know it went through his heart based on the evidence in the record. Did he see Holloway then just a few days after that?
Yes.
So Holloway then, as his treating physician, noted at that point the presence of AFib, even 2-3 days after the shock.
He was not diagnosed with AFib 2 to 3 days after the shock.
But he was noticing the condition.
That was claimant's testimony, was mm-hmm. that he felt that. But Dr. Holloway also testified that AFib through hyperthyroidism comes on quickly. Dr. Elkins actually testified that supports his opinion that the atrial fibrillation was caused by hyperthyroidism because it came on quickly. Now, the studies addressed by Drs. Brody and Dr. Elkins indicated that there was no documented case of AFib more than 24 to 48 hours after an electrical shock. Mr. Arneson attended the emergency room on the day of the event. His heart was thoroughly checked. His EKG was normal. His pulse was normal. His heart rate was normal. Dr. Brody, who's got 40 years of experience as a cardiologist, testified that they looked to see if there was any damage to the heart.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Not a doctor, of course, but as I understand it, the AFib arrhythmia, like all arrhythmias, deals with the electrical functioning of the heart. One thing I wasn't certain of was whether that was even a relevant finding, structural damage being an indicator of an electrical problem.
Yep. So that in combination with the EKG, which was looking at the rhythm, the normal heart rate, the pulse, there was no indication on July 18, 2018, the date of the injury, that there's any damage to the heart. Does that answer your question?
Well, I don't know that. What I don't know is whether that would be revealed by structural damage if it's truly electrical and someone's in a normal rhythm at that point in time. I just don't know.
And I'm almost out of time. So say Dr. Brody also testified that, we're debating this one in 1,000, that only 0.6% of any atrial fibrillation is related to electrical injury.
But there is also testimony in the record about atrial fibrillation developing later, not being revealed immediately upon first examination, but sometime developing afterwards, correct?
No, that was the opposite of the testimony. There was one case where an individual developed it later, but in that article, which was addressed by Dr. Brody, he specifically indicated that the writers of the article did not find a relation or could not find a relationship between the AFib and the electrical shock.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lee, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Justice Myron, I do think that article talks about how a person subjected to an electrical shock did have episodes of AFib 6 weeks later, and I believe Dr. Brody did confirm that that was an accurate assessment based on that article, but I believe that article is a part of the record and is an exhibit if you wanted to read it for yourself. Justice Salter, to your question, on cross-examination, Dr. Brody confirmed that you do not need to have physical damage to the heart in order to have electrical disturbances. We heard from employer and insurer for the last 15 minutes. We've had pages and pages of briefing from them, and still years later, I have not heard one reason why the Department of Labor's decision or any fact was clearly erroneous, which is the appropriate standard that must be looked at when reviewing Judge Fah's decision.
Am I right, though, in thinking, didn't Dr. Holloway sort of relate everything together in the sense that one of his opinions was that the electrocution actually aggravated the hyperthyroidism, which in turn was causing the AFib?
Yes. It caused his hyperthyroidism to become symptomatic and caused the atrial fibrillation. And that is consistent with what the admissions are by Drs. Brody and Dr. Elkins. If you look back to the burden-shifting analysis, I'd be hesitant to ever write an opinion or a decision where judges and lawyers were able to review it for weeks, for years, to find problems with it. Judge Fah's opinion is not perfect when it comes to the second step of the burden-shifting analysis. However, if you look at her decision, she specifically cites 262-4-53 that talks about the burden shifting to the employer. She then talks about the arguments that employer and insurer made as to why Mr. Arneson was employable. She discussed them. She then discussed the experts, the vocational experts, and their opinions. After all of that, she determined that Dr. Audette was more persuasive than the testimony of Dr. Carroll. Again, that's live testimony.
Can I ask a question just about that statute? I'm wrestling with this in my own mind. When you have this burden-shifting sort of formula that we have in the statute, and I understand that it's part of the statute and it says what it says, but when a case is submitted in total to a fact finder, you just have evidence and you have findings, and you have burden of proof, and you either make it or you don't. How fatal would it be if this was decided as all findings of fact are decided based upon the quantum of evidence as it exists, without, hey, there was a prima facie showing, I mean, the hearings and the trials don't go down like that, where we segment them into these constituent parts. We say either you made it or you didn't.
Absolutely. I think when you're making these decisions in the trenches, yes. I mean, she reviewed all the evidence. There were 8 live witnesses. She listened to them, and she determined, I agree with Dr. Audette's testimony that he's not employable over Mr. Carroll's testimony. So I think you're absolutely right, Justice Alter, in that the decision was made.
It could be significant in like a summary judgment context or something like that, where you have jumping off points where you're like, okay, stop, we're not doing the whole fact-finding trial here. But when this is submitted to a fact finder for findings, I'm struggling to see how that really animates when all the evidence is in.
Yeah. I agree, Justice Salter. It's a technical argument, but when you look at the meat of the decision, it's clear that Judge Faugh did discuss all the elements. She looked at the arguments of the opposing side, weighed the evidence, and ruled in favor of the claimant. So
it didn't seem like there were findings. You know, there was a discussion about the obvious unemployability based on his conditions, in her opinion, but it didn't seem like she made findings with regard to the job search or the job. She related what each person testified to, but then there didn't seem to be findings with regard to that part of the consideration. Are there, notwithstanding these conditions, jobs available in his workers' comp range that he could get?
I think according to the testimony of Mr. Audette, there were not jobs that he could do based on his restrictions and his age and his
life. I'm just talking about whether the ALJ made findings in that regard.
A specific finding that would be perfectly fit into this set of facts? No, but I think that again falls back to a situation where it's not a perfect opinion, but like Justice Salter explained, I mean, this is her decision that he is unemployable based on the testimony of all the live witnesses. And I see my time is up unless there are any further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess, back in session tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.